And I'm going to try to totally confound you even worse by teaching you the propromantium and the PTT. So just a very quick review of the coagulation system. We have an extrinsic and an intrinsic system. Okay? Extrinsic and intrinsic system. You want to know how you can tell whether you have attention deficit syndrome? That you watch people when they come in. That's classic distraction. So there's at least 30% of you here that do have that. That's a classic question that's asked on the evaluation thing for attention deficit syndrome. Are you easily distracted? And there's some of you that are big time easily distracted. Big time. You follow all the way up there. It's just unbelievable. Now I can see a guy doing that because they always easily distracted, you know, depending on the sex of the person walking up there. But I mean, when you see women doing that, okay, that is clearly attention deficit. That's true. I'm not making fun. That is absolute truth. That's one of the examples of easy distraction. Easy distraction.
How do you know we're not looking at the guy?
Huh?
How do you know we're not looking at the guy?
Well, you're still distracted. There you go. I was only speaking from my experience. I can't speak from your experience. I caught her on that one. Okay. Now, the extrinsic system has factor 7. End of discussion on the extrinsic system. I want more. That's it. Factor 7. You want more? Factor 7, factor 7, factor 7. How about that for more? All right. Then we have the intrinsic system. That's got 4 dudes in it. It's got 12, 11, 9, and 8. So it's got 4 dudes. 12, 11, 9, and 8. That's your family of 4 for the intrinsic system. Both systems share the same final common pathway. Boom, stop. Okay. I know some other system that looks very similar to this. There was one system, another system, and they honed down on the final common pathway, except it was C3 down. Compliment. You had a classical pathway, you have an alternative pathway, and you had a final common pathway, which you called MAC, you know, that attack unit. Huh? 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 Okay. Very similar with this. Got an extrinsic, intrinsic, and they both use the same final common pathway, except it's 10 that they work on, not C3. So what do we have left? We used up 7, we used up 12, 11, 9, 8. We have 10, 5, 2 is prothrombin, 1 is fibrinogen, clot. That's the end of my discussion. Now let's do the prothrombin time. We abbreviate that PT. The PT detects is evaluates your extrinsic system down to the formation of a clot. So it's only detecting and only dealing with these things right here. So we have 7, 10, 5, 2, and 1. That's all the prothrombin time we'll evaluate. 7, 10, 5, 2, prothrombin, and 1. The end stage of the test is the clot in the test tube. That's it. That's the prothrombin time. The international normalized ratio is just a standardized way of doing it. So no matter what type of reagent you use or no matter what type of instrument you use, you always come up with the same answer. So all it is a standardization technique so that if you go to Mozambique on a vacation and you're on warfarin and you have to get a test done, that you get an international normalized ratio result because it'll be the same no matter where in the world you go. That's all it is. Okay. Now, the PTT, partial thromboplastin time, you already probably figured out, is a test of the intrinsic system all the way down to the formation of a clot. So that would be 12, 11, 9, 8, 10, 5, 2, and 1. That's what the PTT detects. You ready for your first one? This will prove whether you understand it. Your pro time is prolonged, but your PTT is normal. What's the factor deficiency? 7. See, that means you understand it. Now, some of you didn't get that right away, like me. When I initially was presented with this, I was still writing it down, trying to figure it out. I'm not good on crossword puzzles either. Here's how it works. I said the pro time was prolonged, but the PTT was normal. Okay, so the pro time was prolonged means it's either 7, 10, 5, 2, or 1. Is that correct? But we said that the PTT was normal. So that means that 12, 11, 9, 8, 10, 5, 2, and 1 are all normal. So therefore, that leaves only one little dude that could be responsible. That's 7. Another one. Your PTT is prolonged, but your prop time is normal. Play odds. Answer is factor 8. Okay. If your PTT is prolonged, it's either 12, 11, 9, 8, 10, 5, 2, or 1. But I said the pro time was normal. That means that 7, 10, 5, 2, and 1 are normal. So that means it's one of these four coagulation factors. You all know that hemophilia A, next to von Willebrand's disease, is the most common factor deficiency. And so if you played odds, it'd be a factor 8 deficiency. Got it? Okay. Now we're going to really see if you understand what I said. What did warfarin block? Epoxide reductase. Okay, and in so doing, it prevented the gamma carboxylation of what? 2, 7, 9, and 10. Okay. So, what do you usually follow the warfarin? PT. So, what's the only factor that you're not evaluating when you do a prothrombin time to evaluate a person on warfarin? None, because that's in the intrinsic system. But I'm going to ask you a question. What's the PTT in a patient on warfarin? Since you just told me that 2, which is in the final common pathway, well, 7's over here. That's easy to understand. 9 is over here, but that's not measured. But 10 is over here. So two of the factors, 10 and 2, are vitamin K-dependent factors in the final common pathway. So what's the PTT in a patient on warfarin? Prolonged. They're both prolonged. But ProTime does a better job at evaluating it than the PTT. Why? Because 3 out of the 4 things that it's involved in are in the prothrombin time. That's it. It just works better. See, some of you honestly think that the PTT is normal when you're on warfarin. Baloney. Baloney, because 2 of the vitamin K-dependent factors in the final common pathway. Baloney. Whoever taught you that? Baloney. It just works better. The prothrombin time's better. Now, you already know, what do you follow heparin therapy with? The PTT. All right, now I'm going to tell you all the factors that antithrombin 3 knocks off. Are you ready? 12, 11, 7, 10, prothrombin, and thrombin are all neutralized by antithrombin 3. So I'm going to ask you a simple question. The patient's on heparin. Obviously, the PTT is prolonged because there's a whole pile of factors that antithrombin 3 is. What's the protein? Prolonged. It just happens that the PTT does a better job of evaluating a patient on heparin than the protein does. There was a lot of factors, right? I said that 12 was knocked off. I said 11 was. I said 9 was. I said 10 was. I said prothrombin was. And I said thrombin was. Seems like there's a whole lot of factors that antithrombin 3 is involved with that it would inhibit. It just does a better job. But believe me, the proton is prolonged too. Big mistake. And, of course, the boards knows that, and they catch you right and left on that. Right and left on that. So both proton and PTT are both prolonged, whether you're on warfarin or whether you're on heparin. But it just turns out that ProTime does a better job in following warfarin, and the PTT does a better job in following heparin, period. Just got you another point. Dali, what are you up to now? 90. Ooh. Let's keep going, let's keep going, let's keep going. Okay. All right, we'll keep going. Don't you worry, we're keeping going. Let's talk about the fibrinolytic system. Yeah, you see? He's in on this thing, too. Okay, that was staged. Okay, let's talk about the fibrinolytic system. That's my friend Plasmin. Of all the things, I like Plasmin. Because Plasmin's like me. You know, you leave crumbs whenever you eat, right? I mean, just places just crumbs all over your crumbs. So does Plasmin. Because what it does is it breaks down things. It loves to break down fibrinogen and fibrin, and it likes to break down coagulation factors. It destroys things. Fibrinolytic system. It loves especially fibrin to break it down. And so when it does so, there's lots of different pieces that are left over when it breaks open a clot and breaks down fibrin. And they're X, Y, D, and E fragments. That, now you don't have to know that. But we call those fibrin degradation products. It's a simple slide test. It's an excellent test. In fact, one board question was, what's the single best screening test for disseminated intravascular coagulation? The answer is one of these two. So it's either one of the two, but actually the best one's D-dimer. So let's talk about that one. Okay. So what Plasmin does is it breaks things apart, and it leaves crumbs over, which we call degradation products. Oop, oop, I see the same people looking. The same ones looking. I'm going to bring Ritalin with me tomorrow. Just take one Ritalin when you're in here. You'll be fine. You'll have a buzz up the wazoo. Okay? But you will pay attention with Ritalin. Okay. D-dimers, about 1 year ago, went on the exam. I was waiting for it to come because it's the absolute best test for DIC. D, dimers. What's die mean? You're dead? No, means two. Okay, means two. Okay, and what it's detecting, guys, remember when you form a fibrin clot, there's a factor called factor 13 called fibrin stabilizing factor. Well, how do you stabilize strands? You tell me. Link them. Put connections between them, and it makes them stronger. That's what factor 13 does. Is there a concept here? Yeah. How do you make collagen stronger? Link them. That increases the tensile strength. It's a concept. And so that's what fibrin stabilizing factor does. It links fibrin like that, puts a little cross bridge in it. And what D-dimers is detecting is only those fibrin fragments that have a link. In other words, where there's two of them held together, that's what the test picks up. What does it absolutely, unequivocally prove? There was a fibrin clot. Would you see that in disseminated intravascular coagulation? You bet you would. Would you see it if you broke apart a platelet thrombus in a coronary artery? Think. Remember what did I say a platelet thrombus was? I said it was a bunch of platelets stuck together and held together by what? Fibrin. So I'm going to re-ask the question. What would the D-dimer assay be if you actually did break apart that clot D? Increase. You'd see increased D-dimers because you would see those little strands of fibrin that were held together by this cross-linking. Yes, you would. And they do that as a test very, very frequently to see if you actually recanalized or you got rid of your thrombus. Also, it's very commonly used in a pulmonary embolus. You throw off a pulmonary embolus, one test is a D-dimer because you form a clot that will activate the fibrinolytic system. It will try to stop breaking that down, and it will release D-dimers. So this has a lot of uses, guys. This is big time, this dude. Big time. The single best test for DIC that exists. Single best. Wonderful test for picking up a pulmonary embolus along with perfusion scans, ventilation perfusion scans. Excellent test for seeing whether you have reperfusion after you've given tissue plasminogen activator. Because it proves if D-dimers are present, a fibrin clot was there. Fibrin was present. It proves it. Okay. So that's very, very important that you remember D-dimers. All right, let's deal with some diseases, guys. Let's deal with platelet and vessel abnormalities. First, vessel. This exact picture is on part one and part two. It's the back of the hands of an old person. What's so unusual about the back of the hands of an old person? They hit things. This is called senile purpura. Everyone in this room is going to have this when you get older because your vessels get unstable. As you get older, and the amount of subcutaneous tissue thins. And so when you hit yourself, the blood vessels, the small ones, rupture and produce these extensive areas of ecchymoses. This is called senile purpura. It is an age-dependent finding, meaning all of us in this room will have this as we get older. And it should only be present in places that normally hit things, like shins, back of the hands. You know what the part two gave a very interesting thing. They showed these hands and they said this was the only thing that was abnormal in the patient. And they tried to make a case for litigation because they said this was a mommy that was in an old age home and they were going to sue the old age home for abuse of their mommy. And that's, I don't know how they could have worded the question, but they were basically saying, do they have a case? The answer is no. Okay, this has nothing to do with abuse. This just has to do with normal age-dependent finding. Now, they could change that question. And so they said they showed this, and then there were also ecchymoses on the buttocks and back. And that's a different story, because that's not a normal place to get trauma related to just bumping into things. Then that would be abuse. Okay. And this was also on part one. Part one had the same picture. Senile purpura. Everyone here is going to get it, except me. Okay, now, it's very hard to see this, guys, but I will tell you that this person and many people in his family have chronic iron deficiency anemia related to persistent GI bleeds. And you can make the diagnosis by physical exam of the patient And what they have on their fingers are these little small red dots called telangiectasias. And if you look on their lips, you'll see these little red dots, telangiectasias. And if you look in their tongue, you'll see this little red dot, telangiectasias. And if you do endoscopy, you see those little red dots throughout their entire GI tract. Who am I? Osler, Weber, Rondeau disease. Another name, hereditary telangiectasia. They love that question. They love it. It's a genetic, in fact, it's the most common genetic vascular disease. And so you can see why you get chronic iron deficiency, because you're always bleeding because these little telangiectasias rupture. It's kind of like the angiodysplasia of the skin. All right. So these are the two most important vascular diseases I think you should know. Senile purpura and Osler-Weber-Rondeau. Don't forget scurvy, too. That's a vascular instability one as well. Now let's do some platelet things, guys. Remember we told you the signs and symptoms of a platelet disorder. Remember, it would have something where you can't make a temporary hemostatic plug. Epistaxis, nosebleeds, is the most common. Okay, second would be petechia and ecchymoses. And then bleeding from superficial scratches. Bleeding from superficial scratches, because you can't, or cuts, because you can't form temporary hemostatic plugs. Those are all findings, okay? Let's deal with some platelet things. Let's say a kid, he's 12, had an upper respiratory infection a week ago. He now presents with epistaxis. You do a physical exam, and you see these lesions over there. You press on them, and they don't blanch. Why did I say that? Because the boards did. Because the boards did. Because they want to make sure that you know the difference between a petechia and a spider angioma. So you tell me. Well, a petechia blanched. That means go away when you press on it. Of course not, because it's bleeding into tissue. But will a spider angioma go away when you press on? Yeah, it's an arterial venous fistula. Board question, part one. Not hard. Very simple stuff. Okay. Okay, so that's it. Rest of the exam is totally normal. So you did a platelet count to 20,000. What's your diagnosis? Come on, it's a kid. What's your diagnosis? Idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura. Mechanism. IgG antibody against the platelet. Okay, what type of hypersensitivity reaction is that? Two, and who's removing the platelet? Come on. The macrophage is in the spleen, there you go. Why is it removing the platelets? Because it's covered by IgG. You mean then, this is kind of similar to autoimmune hemolytic anemia, right? Except this is autoimmune thrombocytopenia, very good. That's an integration. What do you do about it? Well, they're very, very symptomatic corticosteroids. If they're not, leave them alone. Go away. I'm changing the history. This is a woman that has a positive sphere nuclear antibody test, epistaxis, petechia, but also has splenomegaly and generalized tender lymphadenopathy, lupus. Okay, so it's an autoimmune thrombocytopenia and a patient has lupus. Same mechanism, IgG antibody against the platelet. Type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, macrophage-related removal. That's it. TTP-HUS, thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura hemolytic uremic syndrome. I'm doing both at the same time because they have similar pathophysiology. Now let me take and make a disclaimer immediately. And the disclaimer is, it is not disseminated intravascular coagulation. You are not consuming coagulation factors. The proTime and PTT are totally and unequivocally normal. So it's not that. What is it? Well, basically, remember how we went through the bleeding time? You had small vessel injury, right? You had a temporary hemostatic plug, right? And then the coagulation system converted the fibrinogen to fibrin and made a strong platelet plug, right? That's what you see in TTP and hemolytic uremic syndrome. Something in the plasma damages small vessels throughout your body. So platelets stick. Platelets aggregate, and eventually they form firm platelet plugs in all the vessels, small vessels, in your entire body. Would you consume all the platelets if there was that much sticking going on? Yes, so you'll have thrombocytopenia. Will you bleed because of that? Absolutely. And what do you think you're going to see in your peripheral blood if there's these little platelet thrombi that are nice and strong in every small vessel? What's going to happen to your poor red blood cells? They're going to get smashed into an oblivion, and what do we call those cells? Schistocytes. So you're going to have a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. That's it. So you have thrombocytopenia, You can throw in fever if you want. You can throw in renal failure if you want, because even your glomerular capillaries have these stupid platelet plugs in them. You have to have schistocytes in your peripheral blood with hemolytic anemia, or you can't make the diagnosis. That is absolutely part of the thing. So that's basically the pathophys of both of these. Now, hemolytic uremic syndrome, they do know two causes of it. One you already know is the 01-57-87 serotype E. coli. This is a certain type of toxin-producing E. coli that it can be present in beef. And if you happen to be eating a hamburger that's undercooked and it's got this particular E. coli with this particular toxin, then it's that toxin that damages the vessels and produces the disease. And they call it hemolytic uremic syndrome. Okay, hemolytic, of course, with schistocytes in it, and they're concentrating on uremic, that the renal failure part of it. But they get other things, the brain and all that kind of stuff also. So one of the most common causes of acute renal failure in children is a hemolytic uremic syndrome. So one of the things that does definitely cause this is the 01-57-87 serotype E. coli. You better know that, too. In fact, I know that, and I don't even know my phone number, but I know 01-57-87. And I would, too. Forget your phone number. Know 01-57-87. The other thing that does it is Shigella toxin. It's a very, very potent toxin with shigellosis. That also has been implicated as a vessel injury thing and produced hemolytic uremic syndrome. Okay, so what should we see then in TTP and hemolytic uremic syndrome? We should see low platelet count. What about the bleeding time? Prolonged, but what should the pro time in TTP be? Totally normal. Why? Because you're not consuming coagulation factors, you're only consuming platelets. Don't forget that. We already talked about thrombocytosis, so we don't need to go through that again. All right. We told you that in coagulation deficiencies, they are totally different symptoms than we see and signs than we see in platelet abnormalities. We do not have epistaxis. We do not have petechia. We do not have ecchymoses. Okay? We do not have bleeding from superficial scratches in a coagulation factor deficiency. What we do have is late rebleeding, delayed bleeding, meaning that you can go through an entire operation and with no problem, but when you start moving around, then all of a sudden all hell literally breaks loose and you can actually bleed to death. Now, I want to make sure that you understand something. When you have an operation and you start bleeding out of the wound, the most common cause is not a coagulation factor deficiency. I hope you know that. The most common cause is that, you know, suture slipped or you just have a bleed. I mean, not... But when you have a coagulation deficiency, it's not just a little bit of bleeding, the whole thing. But most of the time it's just due to that there's a bleeder in there. And you just have to just go in there and tie it off. Okay, so please, I don't want you to think that's the most common cause of that. But it can occur in that with that type of scenario. And this is showing a molar extraction in this patient. And you can just see the constant oozing of blood that's coming out of here because there's nothing holding those vessels together, those small vessels. Okay? They were just temporary hemostatic plugs. They didn't have that good fibrin bond on them to hold them together. You understand? Okay. And then this is showing a hemorrhage into a fascial compartment in the thigh. You can see how much bigger this thigh is. And you can also see by looking at this kid's knee versus that one that this kid's had repeated hemarthrosis. So clearly, this patient has hemophilia A, very severe. Okay, you do not see hemarthrosis or bleeding into spaces in platelet abnormalities. You only see it in coagulation factor deficiencies. Very important. Of all the coagulation factor deficiencies, it is a must know the difference between hemophilia A versus von Willebrand's disease. That's the key coagulation factors you need to know on part 1, 2, and 3. 12, 11, 7's worthless. I mean, that's for internal medicine boards. It had nothing to do with these boards. They pick the most common ones. So let's talk about hemophilia A versus von Willebrand's disease. Now, we already know one component of von Willebrand's disease, and that is they're missing von Willebrand's factor, so they have a platelet adhesion defect, which automatically says that they get all the signs and symptoms that one would normally see with a platelet problem. But they also have another problem. They have a factor VIII deficiency as well, but very mild, very, very mild. never severe. So they got two abnormalities. They have a platelet defect and a coagulation factor defect. That's why they could have menorrhagia, okay, and problems like that, GI bleeds, because that's the coagulation part of it. So they're a combo. You'll see histories of epistaxis and easy bruisability. Then on the other side, you get a history of menorrhagia in women, that they've done all these B and C's, and they've studied and right and left, and they can't figure it out. Well, I'm going to tell you why they can't figure it out in a second. All right. There's three parts to the eighth factor eight molecule. You know two of them already. You already know about von Willebrand's factor, and that's abbreviated this way, as you see here. And you already know about 8 coagulant because that was a 12-11-9-8 in the intrinsic system. The one you don't know is the 8 antigen. And basically, it's just a chauffeur. It's just an antigen that carries von Willebrand's factor and 8 coagulant around in the blood. So that's its only function as a carrier protein. But all three of these things can be measured. 8 antigen can be measured, 8 coagulant can be measured, and we measured von Willebrand's factor with the risk of acetyl cofactor acid. Now here it is, guys. This is the key. In patients that have hemophilia A, what is the genetics of hemophilia A? Everyone in this room should know that. Sex-linked recessive. So what does that mean? Males. Classical von Willebrand's disease is autosomal dominant. So there's one difference right there. Different genetics. Different genetics. Remember, in dominant conditions, only one of the parents has to have the abnormality. The other parent can be totally normal, and 50% of their kids could have the potential for being involved. You already know that from your genetics. So there's one difference right off the bat. Okay. Secondly, hemophilia A only has one thing deficient, and that's 8 coagulant. They have normal 8 antigen levels. They have normal von Willebrand's factor. So it's very simple. The hemophilia A is sexually recessive. The only thing abnormal is decreased 8 coagulant, period. Von Willebrand's disease, classical, all three things are decreased. That makes it easy. 8 antigens decreased, 8 coagulant is mildly decreased, and certainly von Willebrand's factor is decreased, all three. Hey, let's see what our little English friend taught you about this. I know a drug that can increase the synthesis of all of these factor 8 molecules, and actually you already heard about this because it comes from a hormone called antidiuretic hormone. It's called DDAVP, is what it's called, or desmopressin. Very interesting. It can cause the synthesis of all the factor 8 molecules, and you don't have to give a blood component. And it will help treat mild hemophilia A. And it's the treatment of choice for von Willebrand's disease. But women. If you have menorrhagia, you've been studied, and you don't have anovulatory bleeding and nothing like that. They've done DNCs. They found nothing. I will guarantee you have von Willebrand's disease. That's the cause of your menorrhagia. I know what they put you on. They put you on birth control pill, and the bleeding went away and got much, much better. And then you wanted to get pregnant, so you went off the birth control pills, and you started bleeding like big time again. Okay, and it's constant history. You go on a birth control pill, everything's great. You go off the birth control pill, you're bleeding to death, and all the studies on you have been negative. You got von Willebrand's disease. You want to know what the problem was? The person that was working you up only got the worst test. They got the prothymin PTT. The PTT turned out to be normal. Okay. And then they did a bleeding time, and that was normal. They said, but you don't have von Willebrand's disease. You know what the sensitivity of the PTT being abnormal and the bleeding time being abnormal is in von Willebrand's? 50%. They picked the wrong test. The test that should have been done on you is the risk acetyl cofactor assay, and I will guarantee you it will be abnormal because you do have von Willebrand's disease. And you want to know why I can tell you that? Because estrogen increases the synthesis of all the factor 8 molecules. So you went on that birth control pill and you got much greater significant relief. It was because you were basically treating your von Willebrand's disease. All of these factors are also made. So there's two things that can increase the synthesis of all the factor 8 molecules. Desmopressin and birth control pill. So the treatment of choice really for women would be a birth control pill. Not desmopressin. Okay. Whoa. All right. Forget circulating anticoagulant. Only thing I'm going to mention about the antiphospholipid syndrome, this is more part two, because this one is the one that is one of the causes of spontaneous abortions. So that's more part two-ish. They don't get too much into part one on this. Antiphospholipid syndrome includes lupus anticoagulant, which is a stupid name, and the anticardiolipin antibodies. Both of these antibodies have one thing in common. They cause vessel thrombosis, which makes you wonder why you call it lupus anticoagulant, doesn't it? I mean, any person in this room, if I said, you have positive lupus anticoagulant, does that mean I'm anticoagulated because I have lupus anticoagulant? No, it means just the opposite. It means that you are actually thrombogenic. Whoever thought of calling it lupus anticoagulant had to be a total idiot, because it's not an anticoagulant. It's part of a syndrome that produces vessel thrombosis. And it's not just seen in lupus, I might add. It's seen in HIV. This anticardiolipin antibody is famous for producing biological false positive syphilis serologies. Now that could be asked on part one. So there you are. You get a VDRL or an RPR and it's positive. Okay, what's the first thing you do? I'm okay, I'm gonna do it. It's me, I'm fine. Okay. But what are they gonna do to double check to see if that was a true versus a false positive? A fluorescent treponine antibody absorption test, FTAABS, would be negative. So what does that make the RPR VDRL? False positive. Because the confirmatory test was negative. Well, why was it positive then, that RPR? Because the test antigen is beef cardiolipin. And syphilis antibodies react against that beef cardiolipin and produce a positive reaction. But so do anticardiolipin antibodies. And so you get a biological false positive syphilis serology. Guess what? You got a woman that's got a biological false positive syphilis serology. What's the very first test she should get? After you do the FTABS. Serum antinuclear antibody. Want to know why? She'll develop lupus. Because anticardiolipin antibodies are a very common feature of lupus. In fact, a biological false positive syphilis serology is one of the criteria for diagnosing lupus because of that antibody. Okay. We already did vitamin K. We already did warfarin. We talked about heparin and how it works. Now let's deal with DIC. DIC, it's easy to diagnose clinically. It's hard to diagnose laboratory-wise. I've never seen the full-blown picture of DIC in the laboratory, never. But we won't go why that is. What is it? Let's take it apart. Disseminated intravascular coagulation. Disseminated all over the body, intravascular, within the vessel, coagulation. So we're clotting. We're forming clots, the same composition that would be in the deep venous part of your leg if you had a thrombus there. We're forming clots throughout the body in small vessels. That's what it is. Now let's think of what's consumed in a clot. Fibrinogen is, 5 is, 8 is, prothrombin is, because that forms thrombin, and platelets are. Okay? Right? So those would be the things that would be consumed in disseminated intravascular coagulation. Well, remember when we do a clot tube? We draw blood into a clot tube, and we form a clot, and we spin it down. What's that called on top? Is that plasma or is that serum? That's serum. So serum is missing all the things that are consumed in clots, which are fibrinogen, 5, 8, prothrombin, and platelets. So when you spin that down, that's when you get serum. Well, that's what you have in DIC. Because you're consuming those coagulation factors, including platelets, in those clots throughout your body. So you got two diseases at once. You've got thrombi in your vessels, and at the same time, you're anticoagulated because all you have circulating around is serum. You don't have plasma because you consume the coagulation factors. Very unusual. That's why it's called a hemorrhagic thrombosis syndrome. You have two things at once. Very unusual. But what started it all off? The intravascular coagulation is responsible for consuming all those things. So what are some of the things that cause that? Well, I'll continue. Numero uno is septic shock. The most common cause of septic shock is E. coli. In fact, you're guaranteed getting DIC. Snake bite. They like that, snake bite. Not the neurotoxin types like cobras or coral snakes, the rattlesnakes. You almost always have DIC with that. That'll prompt it. Okay. ARDS, those kinds of things. Biggest one, septic shock. It's very simple to recognize, guys, because it'll be a patient that's in shock or does have a rattlesnake bite, and here's the key. They bleed from every orifice. Any place where there's a puncture wound, any place where there's a scratch, any orifice in the body, mouth, penis, anus, any place they've had venipuncture bleeds, that's DIC. Very, very simple clinical diagnosis. They bleed out of every orifice, every scratch, every puncture wound, that's disseminated intravascular coagulation. Well, ostensibly, the diagnosis should be incredibly easy because if you're consuming all those clotting factors, proton and PTT should be prolonged. Agreed? Right? Agreed? Platelet counts should be decreased. Agreed? Okay. D-dimers should be positive. Agreed? That's right. Okay. Platelet counts should be decreased. Agreed? Okay. That's classic DIC. Have I ever seen that? Nope. And I've been in the business a long time. But that's not your worry. Because for board purposes, they're going to get the classic case. And all those things will be consumed. If they ask you, they give you a classic scenario, you know for sure it's DIC, they say, which of the following tests would be your test of choice in evaluating this patient? We're going to put D-dimer. There you go. Don't put platelet count. Don't put proton and PT. Lousy sensitivity. Lousy. D-dimer, 99%. Never let you down. Your little friend plasma will never let you down. Okay? Just like those people, you know, when you have free pizza, they're always there, right? Never let you down. They're going to be there. Free pizza. And will there be crumbs left over? Oh, yeah. They can trail them to their house. There'll be crumbs all the way there. Okay. So plasma's just like that. If there's food around, plasma's going to be there. It's going to leave a mess behind. Okay. So that's disseminated intravascular coagulation, the key thing. By the way, amniotic fluid embolism, you know, a thing that's a complication of pregnancy, usually maybe somebody that's had a ruptured placenta, and then they die of what they call amniotic fluid embolism, another misnomer. True, amniotic fluid does get into the circulation of the mommy, but amniotic fluid contains thromboplastin. So really, the death in amniotic fluid embolism is DIC, because the thromboplastin in the amniotic fluid precipitates DIC, and that's why there's such a high mortality in amniotic fluid embolism. It's not the amniotic fluid in their vessels. That doesn't do dork. It just activates DIC. It kills them. Hereditary thromboses, those things that are hereditary, how will you recognize this on an exam? They're always going to say that it's a young person has a deep vein thrombosis. That's not normal. You got a young person has a deep venous thrombosis in the leg, an 18-year-old, that's not normal. You don't usually get them that early, but they'll always on the board say, and it seems to be a propensity in the family for this, then you know they're talking about a genetic disease. And there's a lot of things that do this, so they don't go too crazy on this. Actually, the most common one is factor V Leiden. This is an abnormal factor V that protein CNS cannot break down. It's just a factor V that it just can't break down, so therefore you always have an increase in factor V, which would lead you to thrombosis. That's the most common. The one they like, however, on exams is this one, antithrombin 3 deficiency. And you know what the most common cause is? A woman on birth control pills, actually. So most commonly, it's acquired. That's the most common. But there is a genetic antithrombin 3 deficiency. Would you like me to give you the scenario for that so that how you can remember it? Got a patient with a deep venous thrombosis, okay? So you put them on warfarin, and you put them on heparin, and let's say you do a PTT and it's normal after you give them the heparin, okay? So you check it out and all that stuff to get the right amount, so you give a little bit more heparin. Still the PTT is normal. So you got the history already of deep venous thrombosis, and you got the person on heparin, but the PTT remains normal. It's antithrombin 3 deficiency. Just that easy to recognize. Why? Because heparin isn't what anticoagulates you. It's enhancing antithrombin 3 does. And so if you're giving heparin and it's not causing the PTT to get prolonged, then obviously there's no antithrombin 3. In fact, that's how the diagnosis is usually made. Okay, just by mistake, purely by mistake. OK? Okay. PTT. Oh. This patient's going to have another three deficiency. Okay. Okay. So that's how it's usually made. That's the way they usually ask the question on the exam. Okay? Well, let's see if you learn anything. These are the four tests, platelet count, bleeding time, proton time, and PTT, that are the basic tests that you want to evaluate a patient's hemostasis, general hemostasis. This would be the group of tests that you'd want. And so this is the one they usually ask on boards. These are the kind of the values they give you on exams. So let's see if you could do it without any choices. You're going to fill in the blanks. All right, someone's on aspirin. What's the platelet count? Normal. What's the bleeding time? Prolonged. Okay, what's the proton time and PTT? Normal. All right, you got your first one right. Okay, how about idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura, the most common cause of thrombocytopenia in kids? Platelet count? Low. Bleeding time? Prolonged. Proton time, PTT? Normal. All right. Let's throw in TTP and hemolytic uremic syndrome. It's not up here, but what would you put for that? Platelet count? Low. Bleeding time? Prolonged. Proton time and PTT? Very good. Doing good so far. All right. How about hemophilia A? Platelet bleeding time? Normal. Proton time? Normal. PTT? Prolonged, because that's in the intrinsic pathway. Very good. Now notice I put von Willebrand's disease right next to hemophilia A to see if you can make the difference. Okay, what's the platelet count in von Willebrand's disease? Normal. What's the bleeding time? Prolonged. What's the proton time? Normal. And what's the PTT? Prolonged. Very good. So what's the main difference between von Willebrand's disease and hemophilia, at least in terms of laboratory tests? Bleeding time. Very good. And why do they have a bleeding time problem? Because they're missing von Willebrand's factor, which is a platelet adhesion factor. There you go. Okay, if you want warfarin or heparin, what's your platelet and bleeding time? Normal. What's your proton time and PTT, and whether either one? Prolonged. But what's the one that's better for warfarin? Proton time, specifically the international normalized ratio version of it, and which is the one that you usually use for heparin? PTT. You got it. I now pronounce you experts on coagulation disorders. It's hot in here, isn't it? Blah. Must be me. Must be a lot of hot air, huh? Blood bank. Let's see if we can get the temperature up or down. And the brake cars. Probably something screwed up. Blah. Okay, how many of you blood group O, most common one? Okay, so what antibodies you have floating around your plasma? Anti-A, IgM, anti-B, IgM. Listen to this one, because most of you don't know this. Anti-AB, IgG. Whoa. Okay, how many of your blood group A, the second most common one? All right. What do you have floating around your blood? Don't say anti-A, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting there, you'd be dead, okay? What do you have floating around in there? Anti-B, IgM. How many of your blood group B, the third most common one? Okay, what do you got floating around your blood? Anti-A, IgM. How many of your AB, the rarest of the rare? There we go, we got one dude. What do you got floating around? We got one more where? Who? You? Wonderful. Hey, shake your hand. Oh, this is wonderful. All right. Okay. What do you have floating around your bloodstream? Nothing. Okay. Very good. Because if she's AB, you don't want anti-A and anti-B. Okay. Now, these are all obvious things, but oftentimes when you take a test, you kind of blank out. How about a newborn? What do they have floating around their blood? Nothing. Well, what if their blood group O? Nothing. A. Nothing. B. Nothing. AB. Well, they shouldn't have anything anyway. They don't have any. Why? Newborns don't begin synthesizing IgM until they're born. That's why. And those are IgM antibodies. And it's only after 2 to 3 months they begin synthesizing IgG. So they do not have isohemoglobins. How about old men? Old women? What do they have? Hardly any. And that's what came up the board question. They said that an old person was blood group A and received by mistake blood group B blood and didn't develop a hemolytic transfusion reaction. And they said, why? The answer is their levels of antibodies are so low when you get older that they didn't have anything around that would attack those cells. That's what the answer was. That was part one. It was very clever. That's not to say you can just give them any blood you want, but I'm just saying that we don't have, I'm saying we because I'm getting into that category, that high an antibody level. Okay? All right. Good. Which is the one of these things associated with gastric cancer? A. Which one with duodenal ulcer? O. Okay. Who's the universal donor? Can give their blood to anybody? O. Why is that? Because they're O. They have no A or B antigen. And so if you're A, okay, you have anti-B, who cares? You're not going to attack me. Okay, so the universal donor. But what's the only blood I can get? I'm blood group O. What's the only blood I can get? O. Okay, so I have to have O. Okay? Who's the universal recipient that can get any blood? AB. Why? Because they have no antibodies to attack those cells. Now, in reality, we just don't give blood. We try to match it. But also, there's some exceptions to that, but we won't tell you about that. Oh, just a few interesting things in terms of R. How many of you are blood group D? How many of you are, let's say, Rh positive? Okay, now, you know what that means? See, there's five Rh antigens. There's D antigen, there's big C, little c, big E, little e. There's five Rh antigens. So which one, when you say you're Rh positive, does that mean you're positive for all of these or just one of them? Just one of them, which one is it? D. Doesn't tell you dork about what the other antigens are. So Rh positive means you're D antigen positive. You're Rh negative, you're D antigen negative. Okay, good. Lewis antibodies, that's part two. Duffy antigens, part one and two. Duffy antigen is missing in the black population. And because of that, you are not as likely to get Plasmodium vivax malaria. Whoa. Why might that be, Dr. Goyon? Because the antigen that the P. vivax needs to parasitize the red blood cells is Duffy antigen. And so if you don't have it on your red blood cell, P. vivax can't get into it. Okay. Remember those anemias we talked about, alphas, and beta thalassemias, and sickle cell, and G6PD? What malaria does that protect black population from? That's falciparum. You want to know why that is? Because all of those anemias have, the RBCs have a shorter lifespan. And so the malaria parasites can't live out their cycle in the RBC because the RBC has a shorter lifespan, and so that protects the individual from getting falciparum. Just a shorter RBC lifespan, that's all. Okay, I antigen forget, major cross match. Major cross match. When you say I want Joe to get blood, what is the major cross match? That's the patient that's going to get the blood serum and in a test tube with the blood of the donor unit that they're supposed to get. They mix the two together. So it's the patient's serum with the donor's red blood cells and mix them together and see if they're compatible. What we're looking for really, is there anything in the patient's serum that's going to attack antigens in the donor red blood cell? That's basically the purpose of the major cross match. That's all it's going to say. But you should already know whether there's antibodies in the patient's serum because another part of the workup for cross-matching people is to do an antibody screen, which I told you is what? A direct Coombs or an indirect Coombs? An indirect Coombs, that's right. And so if that's negative, then 99.999% of the time, when you do a major cross-match, that's compatible because all it's really detecting is whether there's an antibody in the patient's serum, not the donor unit serum, the patient's serum that's going to attack the donor red blood cells. Now, you have to do a separate cross match for every unit of blood. You don't just dump in your serum and then put a little bit of blood from one unit and a little bit of blood from the other unit. Separate cross match for each one. Okay, and you do that. Does that prevent you from getting a hemolytic transfusion reaction? No. Does that protect you from developing antibodies at a later date? No. What's the chance that any of you in this room have the same antigenic makeup on your red blood cells as I do? Zero. So if you are my blood type, blood group O, you gave me your blood, I can assure you I don't have all the antigens that you have on your blood group O, and I will develop antibodies against them. So every stinking unit of blood that you give a person, you increase the risk of developing antibodies. And that means then when a time comes up to get another transfusion, they have to go and find units of blood that are negative for that antigen to which you have antibodies, which increases cost and the time it takes to cross-match you. Moral of the story, don't transfuse unless it's absolutely necessary. Let's break. Let's see if we can get the air a little lower here.